House Committee on Healthcare, an open and informational meeting on the question of the possibility of extending health insurance expanding dependents coverage from what's now typically age 23 or 21 or some other age to age 30. And I'll ask Representative Cannon to kick us off.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, committee. I'm very excited about this opportunity. I'm really just going to introduce the two women sitting to my right, Erin Cecil Levine and Sarah Cassidy. They brought this concept to me a year ago when they were both students at Willamette Law School. Since that time, I've met with some folks in industry as well as advocates who all seem to be interested, at least, in this concept and certainly interested in helping us move it forward in the form of a bill towards 2009. So I appreciate the opportunity to present it today, to get some feedback, to hear from some of the industry stakeholders about their reactions to it, and to begin to get some consideration as we move towards 2009. But I'm very glad that Erin and Sarah are here. I think they can tell you about their interest in this concept and some of the reasons for it. I would draw your attention to the packets that you've received, and we have a one-pager that should be on top that's sort of the highest-level overview of this concept. It says providing more health insurance options for young adults. I'll let them sort of explain where we're coming from and why we're doing it, and then I will finish up, and then we'll hear from some other folks as well. So thank you very much, and I don't know which one of you wants to start, but go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Greenlick and Representative Cannon and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Cassidy. I'm currently a second-year law student over at Willamette University College of Law. And Erin and I began this as a project last year for our introduction to law and government class. And it came to our attention just from our own experiences dealing with finding coverage, health insurance coverage, at this point in our lives. At the time it came to my attention, I was 26. My boyfriend was 26. He lost coverage as he changed jobs. Picked up coverage again 2 months later on my plan. We both decided to go back to school. He applied for coverage and was denied twice due to pre-existing conditions and was without coverage for 2 months before he enrolled in school. Myself, I was more fortunate and did find coverage to cover that particular gap. So in addressing what we thought could be a solution, we found a bill in New Jersey, which Erin will speak a little bit more about, that extended dependent health care coverage to age 30. But some of the more interesting things we found were just the statistics. The numbers alone helped bring this to our attention. And to sort of highlight some of these, the most recent statistics on the one sheet that Representative Cannon has prepared kind of highlights the disparate effect on this particular age group, ages 21 through 29. If you look, the current figures in Oregon show that for 21 through 24-year-olds, the percentage of uninsured, is 41.6%, and then ages 25 to 29, it's 31.8%. And both of those are set aside by the 18 to 21 population, which has the lower percentage rate, much more in line with the state uninsured rate, which I think currently is around 16%. And same with over 30, the rate declines again. So we decided we would target this particular age group and look at other facts. Most insurers, if there's a policy brief, if you go to the Commonwealth Fund website, which is commonwealthfund.org, they've done a number of surveys and have found that among employers that offer coverage, nearly 60% of them do not insure dependents over age 18 or 19 unless that dependent is in college full time. They've also found that contrary to myth that this particular age group does not care about their health or thinks that they're invincible, when they look at the take-up rate by this age group, compared with 30-year-olds or above, the young adult age group will take up employer-offered coverage 73% of the time compared to the above 30, which will take it up 80% of the time. So offering another option, we thought, would be a good place to start to help bring the numbers in line. That's all I have to say. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you, and thank you to Representative Cannon for allowing us to be here. As Sarah mentioned, I too have a personal story that was the impetus for our interest.
Would you identify yourself?
Oh, excuse me. My name is Erin Cecil Levine, and I graduated last year from Willamette University College of Law. When I was 26, I had a personal, not an injury, but something that I was forced to be hospitalized, and insurance, I fell off my parents' plan and was trying to get personal insurance on my own, but it was sitting on someone's desk because I had a pre-existing condition of migraines. And since it was sitting on someone's desk, it was in a file, and in the interim, I was hospitalized and racked up $18,000 in a day and a half. And thus, my personal interest in keeping people under 30 on plans so that they didn't experience similar things. The sheet that you just received is an addendum to the one sheet. 13 states in the last year have enacted similar legislation to the bill that we were proposing to you, that the majority is keeping students or dependents who are still on their parents' financial, not constraints, what's the word I'm looking for?
Dependency,
thank you. The majority is up to the age of 25, but when we were working on our proposal, we modeled it after New Jersey. The New Jersey plan keeps a dependent, which is a child by blood or law, up to the age of 30, who is unmarried and has no dependents of their own, and is a resident of the state of New Jersey or is a full-time student of an accredited school of higher learning. Has to be an accredited school. And there is no requirement that an employer provide insurance. It is solely on the policyholder to provide the dependent coverage. So we have kept our proposal based on that as well. There are 13 states, as I mentioned, and Idaho and Washington are in this plan. Some require that the dependent reside with their parents. Some require that they be a full-time student, and others require that they be a resident of the state. If you notice on these 13, they're all different. But they all basically follow the parameters of the New Jersey model that we followed as well. I did forget to put the URL, and I'm not sure if it's on the one sheet, but it's www.ncls.org. Yeah, thank you. And that way you can see everything that's going on across the country. There were four states on the one sheet that are dead now. Florida was killed by the insurance lobbyists. Illinois was...
State's still alive, I assume.
Was it?
I say the state is still alive.
Oh, yes, the bill was killed. Thank you.
Thought I had missed the new news.
No. Illinois was re-referred to the Rules Committee. Minnesota was returned to Commerce and Labor Committee, and Rhode Island is being held for further study.
Well, I just want to finish up by thanking these folks for bringing this to our attention and encouraging your consideration of the issue. I think the idea here really is to provide young people with more options with respect to their health insurance. So the point is not to require young people to stay on their parents' plans. There are, for many young people, particularly those who don't face the sort of pre-existing condition situation that you heard described, there are options in the insurance market, some of which may be more affordable and better options for a 20-something. But it seemed to me to make a lot of sense to give, particularly at a time when we are encouraging continuity of care, we're hoping that someone will maintain the same relationship with the same primary care provider that they've had over long periods of time, particularly in that kind of climate, it made a lot of sense to try to encourage or try to give the option to young people to stay with the plan that they have grown up on and know. As I think it was really important that we heard that, of course, nothing about this would require an employer to pay for the continued dependent coverage. That would be up to the employer and their benefits program. But to have the option out there seemed to make a lot of sense. And I think we'd be happy to take questions.
No questions? Senator Maher?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess at the end of the day, this is, it's going to come down to whether or not this encourages adverse selection.
Keep it alive.
If you're getting people that have a pre-existing condition and they have a real compelling reason to stay on the insurance, then it's going to change the dynamics. I'll be very interested because I'm assuming we've got quite a bit of information as this rolls out across the country in different forms. There's really nothing conceptually that's wrong with getting more people insured, but the devil's in the details, and I think it'll be very interesting to hear the dynamics of the for and against and see how that plays out. But this is good. Having young people involved and coming forward with good ideas and at least pushing the envelope of what's possible. So thank you.
Can I just respond to that quickly? I think we may hear more about that adverse selection question from some of the folks who will follow us. It may be an issue. It may also be the case that the number of, you know, generally healthy young people who stay insured as a result of this option would offset whatever adverse selection issues that you might raise, and I think that's something that we'll need to look into more. I would also say, in a sense, it's that adverse selection piece that makes this especially important. It's the fact that a young person who's age 23, if they're lucky enough to keep it to age 23, then gets booted from their parents' plan, and it's the young person who has the pre-existing condition and doesn't have somewhere else to go because they're rejected by individuals insurance companies and run up the, or the individual plans and run up the $18,000 in debt. So
or they'll end up in the high risk pool where we're subsidizing it from all the other insurances rather than carrying their own weight.
Yeah.
Just as an aside, when this, you know, when you first started, there's an image in my mind, a movie called Failure to Launch. And say, well, sorry, I can't get married because I got to keep my insurance. And
yep. President Codet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here today. This is a really interesting topic. I was wondering, and this might be something the insurance industry can also answer, is when you were doing your research, how did the idea of covering dependents up to a certain age range and whether or not they were in school, what's the history of how they settled on these age ranges? And I'm just curious because
it seemed from, at least with the New Jersey plan, that they were facing the same sort of numbers. And the assemblyman, Neil Cohen is his name, he was the one that fronted that bill, just took it as a way to address the issue. And I didn't particularly, and Aaron, I don't know if you did, found any more information as far as the history goes. But it did seem as if more and more states were expanding the notion of what does dependent mean, especially looking at modern society and how many students aren't going straight from high school into, you know, college or aren't going at all or go for a year, then drop and come back. So,
and follow-up?
Please.
Well, and there's the overlap also of the movement to require coverage if you're in college, if you're not covered under your parents, to purchase what is essentially very modest, catastrophic coverage that doesn't do you a whole lot of good unless, you know, you're ending up in the hospital, which is good to have, but in terms of preventive care and things like that, those plans are fairly limited. And maybe there's been the impression that if you go to, you know, if you buy one of those plans, everything's good. But then once you're out of school, you're not buying that plan anymore. So it hasn't really dealt with that issue, I don't think. But
May I respond to that? In particular, my own boyfriend, we were looking at the plans by the schools, and it came the idea of options, and that's one thing that New Jersey looked at too, that in New Jersey there are about three different options, and this was just one more that dealt with continuity of care, and it dealt with how much coverage and what the choices were for the individual covered. And that's what we were hoping to do here in Oregon as well, is to just expand the options for the individual.
Thank you.
Representative Richards?
I have a comment and question, or actually just like to let you know first, I think it's great that you're coming forward and that you're giving such thought to this. I can also respond to Representative Kotek that I got my life and health license as an agent in 1972 and became involved in group insurance and health insurance, and the insurance coverage for dependents went to age 19. And then it went over the years to 21 and then to 23. But the issue was about emancipation. In other words, if a child is a member of a family, then why should they lose their coverage at 20 instead of 19 or 21 or 22? What you're proposing is that there should be group insurance coverage for emancipated adults instead of unemancipated minors, and then minors extended to while they're at college. You're living with your boyfriend, and so you're no longer part of the family, but rather than become responsible for your family unit, married or unmarried, the idea is, why don't we have coverage continue on our parents' policy, even though we're acting like adults and emancipated in our life? And that is a shift in a policy consideration, and it's a shift in premium and cost, because with the coverage, you can have more bills paid by that policy. Group insurance is spread over a group, so there's going to be more claims for that group, which means other people that are paying premiums will be subsidizing emancipated adults who still have coverage because they would like to have somebody else pay for their bills than their own insurance company, whether it be student insurance because of being in college or your private policies or whatever. And so it's about having somebody else pay for my coverage from a philosophical viewpoint, because now it's expanding family group insurance to emancipated children that are no longer part of the family but have their own family unit. And so to carry that to that extent changes a lot of the view and underwriting, and we'll also be interested in hearing what the insurance industry has to say about how that affects group insurance rates and those kinds of things. Certainly worth looking at, but there are consequences to it.
Yeah, I don't know about your family, but I know lots of families where kids think they're emancipated, but they still end up being unemancipated in a lot of ways.
Living with their boyfriend in my family, that means you're emancipated. But maybe somebody else is a little different, you know.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the handout that's titled Providing More Health Insurance Options for Young Adults, it says that currently Oregon law only requires that health care policies include dependents up to the age of 19. Is that the whole scope of what's required here, or are there some exceptions? I have a personal interest in this. having an almost 20-year-old.
You're semi-emancipated.
Need to figure out what to do here.
Representative Bonamici, Mr. Chair, you're in the fortunate position that your son is a student, and therefore, I believe, under most under Oregon rule, and I believe it's administrative rule, not statute, he is a dependent, or maybe a dependent, for the purpose of health care up to age 23. That's where you get the expanded list up to 23. Is that consistent with your understanding of?
With our understanding, I don't know offhand the particular rules or ORSs. We were going off of just the trends in the insurance industry from what we could find on national numbers.
Thank you.
We can ask our later guests about that. Representative Cookie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just wanted to respond to Representative Richardson, because in some ways, like in my family, when I moved out here, I was no longer a dependent for a variety of reasons, and so I fell off the plan. But I know if I had had a medical issue, my parents would have done anything they could financially to help me out. So in some ways, the parent is still on the hook. And so if I were a parent, when I'm a parent, I'd want to be able to keep that child covered as long as possible, because I'm going to possibly be footing the bill down the line. So although I understand what you're saying about when are you actually, emancipated, I think some families probably think, I'm always going to be, to some degree, financially wanting to take care of my kid if something happens, and so they get to have that choice to pay for them in a different way, which is keeping them on their plan. So I don't know if that makes sense, but
no, I'm going to be very careful about this because my kids may hear what I say. Could I ask a question, please? Would you be willing to share with us what happened to that $18,000 bill?
I paid most of it, and then I ended up having to declare bankruptcy. Oh. I paid $10,000 of it.
You cleared bankruptcy a little earlier, huh?
I was doing what I could.
That's great. Thank you. That is the problem. And, of course, these kinds of things represent, my understanding, is about 40% of all bankruptcies.
But if I may say something, Chair
Greenwood. Please do.
Vice Chair Richardson, the school insurance that we have at Willamette in particular, $2,000 max coverage. That's all they pay.
That's not insurance.
Yeah. And I just had a ruptured disc and had surgery, and they paid $10,000 of that, and I'm on the hook for the rest. And I will pay that because now I'm working, but it doesn't. It's not insurance. It doesn't. That.
No, I bet it's a prepaid medical plan, meaning it helps you get minor care treatment, things like that, but not catastrophic loss.
Right. $2,000 per incident. And that's it.
Thank you very much. Any other comments? And Representative Cannon, thank you very much for bringing this issue to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for
to join us here.
Yep.
Yeah, thank you really for your time.
Thank you for your time.
I think Representative Cannon modeled the kind of tie people should wear when they're testifying here. if they choose to wear a tie. We've asked some folks from the insurance industry to join us. I hope they understood clearly. We're not trying to put them on the hook in any way. And I just thought it would be very useful if we had some reaction to this. Something we'll be thinking of in the interim, and it would be really good to hear what you all are thinking about. You all look familiar.
Never put on.
Is that good or bad?
It's good. It's good. Well, it's good for me. My memory is good.
At our age, it's good.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlich and members of the committee. Elise Brown representing AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans. And I'm happy to be here today to provide comments on the issue of dependent health insurance coverage or extending it, and applaud Representative Cannon for bringing the issue and looking for creative ways to deal with the problem that we have in Oregon with uninsured. First, AHIP has a great resource, and some of these materials have been shared in other forms, but AHIP has a state chart. It provides all the requirements that are happening in other states, and I have that available online for all of you. I didn't print it. It's a 47-page document, so I can share that with you separately or send it to you electronically.
I think it would be great if you would send the
I'd be happy to.
The website for us.
But first, I just wanted to do a little background and maybe set the stage, and we'll let John Powell with Regents, who's one of our members, pick up where I leave off. First of all, health insurance plans with coverage for dependent children usually establish an age after which dependent is no longer eligible for coverage. So the typical provision allows for eligibility for dependents around the age of 19, which has been mentioned, or for full-time students until they reach the age of 23. Most policies also require children to be financially independent on and reside with their insured parent or non-custodial parent to have the legal obligation to provide financial support for health care coverage.
I'm sorry, did you say independent or dependent?
Financially dependent.
Dependent, yeah.
Right. And recently, some states have enacted laws to address the coverage for potentially uninsured dependent children. So we're talking about the state of New Jersey right now. Raising the age to which eligibility for coverage must extend, requiring continuation for coverage for college students during medical leave from school, or requiring policies to extend coverage for adult children who neither reside with or financially depend on the insured parent. So some of the approaches that are mentioned in the AHIP state chart talks about 47 states where the age the insurer can or must use to end the individual's eligibility. Boy, that's a tongue twister. And of the 23 states, including Oregon, the limit is age 19. The other states have established different limiting ages from anywhere from 18 to 30, again, already mentioned. So, again, my comments are mainly focused on what New Jersey's doing. And just to close with a comment about, just in general speaking terms, that AHIP and members do not oppose laws extending the age limit by a couple of years. But the New Jersey model, I believe, goes too far and creates the unintended consequences that Representative Richardson just addressed. Allowing children to continue coverage under their parents' employer's coverage drives up the employer's premium, potentially causing the employer to drop coverage. So I think, you know, we're talking about what do we do then. Some of the things that I think that the state can continue to do, and I think we're doing that now in a variety of different venues, is looking at ways to keep...
Excuse me, can I ask?
Sure.
Would that raise the employer's premium even under the conditions that I thought I heard that it would be the family's responsibility to pay the additional premium? Would it affect the risk coverage in other ways?
Well, it affects the employer's premium.
Even if the extra amount is paid by the employee rather than the employer?
Well, I mean, when we're talking about group coverage, an employer is going to be responsible for paying the premium there.
He may get it from the employee, but the employer still writes the check.
Well, or maybe not, but I thought the conditions we were talking about was that it would not add any additional burden on the employer, but it would be fully paid by the family. Is that what I heard you say?
Mr. Chair, this may require some additional working out, mm-hmm. but my assumption is that the insurance company charges the employer, if you will, whatever it costs to provide the benefit. The employer has some benefit set for the employee, and for some employers at some workplaces, that's a great benefit that includes all the total coverage of all the dependents that you've got all the way to whatever age. Other employers might choose to say, well, you get $500 a month to spend on to be applied towards your family's health insurance. And ultimately, my understanding would be it's up to the family to decide how to meet that whatever additional obligation remains under the plan that's provided by their employer.
And it's something the employer might pick up, but they
sure
it wasn't
yeah.
intention.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, please go ahead.
So one of the things I was suggesting that we do is look at the products that we have available now, both in the individual market and the group market, and make sure that we keep them affordable. By looking at less mandates or mandate-free products. So I did want to add one other thing to Rep. Bonamici's comments about what Oregon is currently doing. Again, the age limitation in Oregon is dependents are covered up to the age of 19. There are no provisions right now for students. There's what I mean by provisions is that there's no requirements. It doesn't mean that insurers here in Oregon aren't covering them, and we'll let Regents address that. Disabled dependents, there are no provisions, but I believe back in 2005 there was a law that allowed for disabled adult children to be covered. So those are some of the things that Oregon is doing now, and would close by just saying that AHIP look forward to being a resource to Representative Cannon and this committee as you look at this issue in the interim and coming up with some kind of a solution in 2009. Thank you.
Representative Maher.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And this question may be answered a little later, but in rate, not rate bands, but there are four different rate categories. You have employee, employee spouse, employee children, and employee family, which covers everybody. And if you, regardless of whether you have one child or six kids. And so separating out what percentage is from child number one and child number six and that dynamic, I think, may be difficult. I'm sure the insurance companies could figure it out, but... I think that would be a very interesting question if they could address that.
Yeah, that rate band thing has always been interesting to me, and sometimes it's single person, two adults, a single person and a child, and two adults and a child, and then full family. I mean, there can be lots of combinations of that varies by
But you know, my family made out on that.
I bet you did. We were helping to subsidize you. So much for individual responsibility.
We had eight daughters, and they all had a brother. And so there was a bunch. So we did okay on that, although they were very helpful. Yeah, you know, they were girls, and so there were very few broken bones. But we didn't have those either.
Please, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Thanks to Representative Cannon, who was kind enough to let us know that he was interested in this issue some months ago. We have been doing some research on it. However, that research isn't complete because of another kind thing you all did a few months earlier than that, and that was passed Senate Bill 329. And we're finding at Regents we don't have enough bodies to cover all the ground that's being covered. So everybody's been very, very busy. And so much of our compilation of the data we have today is very recent. I would simply say at the outset, as Elise has referred to, Regents is dedicated to trying to ensure 100% of the population when, if that's possible. You know, if you sell apples and the legislature passes a bill that everybody has to eat an apple every day, you're a happy camper. So if everybody has to have insurance, we're a happy camper. But we all know what the limitations are as we've gone through gyrations of reforms over the years. And it always comes back to is it affordable and to whom and who makes up the subsidies if it's not. Let me start today by just addressing a few of the issues that have already come up. One, where do the outlines of the insurance dependency come from? They come from the IRS. And the definition of a dependent, besides residency and financial dependence by the IRS, is a person must be under the age of 19 at the end of the year, under age 24 and be a full-time student for at least 5 months during that year, and then any age and totally, if you're totally and permanently disabled. And those are basically the guidelines of insurers taken from the IRS, which brings up a side issue to the discussion that's taking place right now. And that is, if a benefit is delivered to somebody who is not a dependent under the IRS guidelines, that is likely, and I'm saying likely because we have not finished the research on this, a taxable benefit.
If it's employee paid, employer paid.
That's right, Mr. Chairman. And if the parents are receiving that benefit, then through their policy, I guess the tax liability would come to them. I don't know who would be liable. But in the case of an employer who's passing that on, our research also indicates a question whether or not that's a deductible expenditure. That is, that particular premium, if paid by the employee, by the employer, the question is whether or not that is a tax-deductible expenditure. And we're going to continue to do that research and pass that information on to you.
Mr. Chair, isn't this a fundamental question that's being asked around the country about insurance and tax deductibility? And I mean, because this raises a huge question about the individual deductibility of health insurance. And so isn't this just in line with that whole conversation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Maurer, I believe it is part of that same discussion. At what point does it become a benefit the same as cash, and that's taxable?
When I was working at Kaiser and got life insurance based on my income, I got a notice every year for the premium paid for the amount over $50,000 worth of life insurance, and it came through. It was obviously a deductible expense for the employer, but it came through to me as a cash charge.
Same is true with disability insurance, Mr. Chairman. If you if the coverage life pays the premium for disability insurance, the benefits are non-taxable. If your employer pays the benefits of that policy and you're disabled and you start collecting, you pay taxes on that benefit. So it is complex, and we will continue to research that area and try to help the committee as you continue your deliberations on this. Another issue that came up earlier was the impact on premiums. And I think Representative Maurer had pointed out the categories that most policies cover. It's individual, an individual with child, or individual spouse and child, individual spouse, child, or children. And there's usually no breakdown for additional children. So if we're going to add a category that extends beyond the current age, that will have some impact on that category of premium. And between the age of 24 and 30, there's probably close to a 10% differential in that premium, just due to age.
Mr. Chair, could you say that again and clarify it? I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Cannon, the basic difference in the premium between a 30-year-old and a 24-year-old would be roughly 10%, maybe a little more.
Okay.
And again, it's 10% of a smaller amount. It's not of the entire policy. So if you went out to buy an individual policy, which was age-rated, you'd be up about 10% in that after 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
Still relatively cheap.
President Cote?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So were you suggesting we'd have to create another band, say, adult, you know, employee, spouse, and kids over 24?
Mr. Chairman.
Because I would guess kids would be in, you know, clumped in age ranges, theoretically.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cote, I'm not sure that would happen. I think what would happen is the insurer would have to find a basis at which to add premium to that overall category where these people would be.
Okay.
So it'd be the children.
For the family.
Total.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
John, I'm going to ask you at the end, and you may need Mike to help with this one. Would it be feasible for, say, Regents to bill a family independently for that kid? I mean, that there. I guess it is a kid by definition, we're saying. But I, as a state employee, have fully paid health insurance. If I want to add a 28-year-old kid, would it be conceivable for the insurance company to bill me separately from, including administrative costs, for the additional premium for that child? Is that something that's feasible?
Mr. Chairman, when I was building a house many years ago, the builder, when my wife would inquire as to whether we could do this or that, he would say, we can do anything. Some things just cost more than others.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be administratively burdensome because you would have to keep track of those individuals under that child category separate from any others. Because currently, in some cases, you don't know who they are until a claim comes in, and then it's verified. So it would be very difficult. Obviously, feasible.
Sort of a COBRA model. So we were both thinking of. And once a child becomes 23,
pay their own for 18 months.
Which basically leads me to my next point, Mr. Chairman, and that is Oregon portability law. Currently, someone who loses coverage has 63 days, I believe it is, to derive an individual policy from that group insurer. And under Oregon law, that policy has to carry all the mandates. So it's more expensive than an individual policy, but it has more coverage as well. So part of the reforms going back to the 80s and moving forward, besides the high-risk pool, is our change in portability law requiring insurers who sell group insurance in Oregon to guarantee coverage to anybody that leaves that group. With that, Mr. Chairman, again, we're going to continue working on this. The New Jersey experiment went into effect in 2006, so we really don't have information from that state yet. I'm sure that Senate Bill 329 eligibility and other subcommittees of that group will be happy to look at this as well as we go through that process.
And thank you.
Thank you for your time. And again, I want to thank Representative Cannon for letting us know well in advance about this, and not feeling blindsided is a very good feeling.
Any other questions, Mr. Call?
Good afternoon. I'm Doug Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. These are health insurance agents and brokers throughout the state. And they've started looking at this issue over the last few months. Part of that came out of the work that Massachusetts did. And if any of you have read a lot about how Massachusetts went through their process, one of the first things that they did was look at analyze the uninsurance pool. Who's uninsured? For how long? What does that look like? And your committee got a national picture of that last week or 2 weeks ago when Ed Hasselmeyer presented about that breakdown by age and income range about uninsurance. And if you remember, a large part of what they found was that there's a relatively small group of chronically uninsured, low income, don't have insurance, probably aren't going to have insurance unless the state provides it or subsidizes it. But there's a relatively significant block of people who are in and out of insurance. And the policy goal then becomes to help people keep insurance. You don't have to get them insurance, you just have to help them keep insurance. A lot of the young people in this age bracket fall into that category. The two Willamette Law students who spoke earlier talked about this report from the Commonwealth Fund. And in the state's profile of Oregon's uninsured that comes out each year, which is where that chart that shows the 41 and 38% uninsurance rate for the 20-somethings, they quote, and if I may just read two sentences here, the Commonwealth Fund brief indicates that young adults become uninsured primarily as they age off of their parents' coverage or government programs, such as SCHIP, and work at jobs that are often low wage and temporary. The report also estimates 40% of college graduates and over 50% of high school graduates will be without health insurance at some point during the first year. Again, it's that they age off of something, they drop off, they have a gap, and then they somehow pick up other insurance. And I think, as many of you, I also have children in this age bracket, and both with my kids and seeing their friends go through this, I've watched them, they have insurance because they're a full-time student for one term, but then they take off because they decide to get a job or travel or do something else for 6 months, so they're not insured for 6 months, and then they get another job short term that maybe provides benefits, they pick up insurance, but it's different providers, then they go back to school. And so it's, you know, if continuity of care is important, the current system is not a great way of keeping that. So some of the concerns, the health underwriters met with Aaron and with Representative Cannon over the last few months to talk about this. The issue of selection certainly came up. If there is a broad concern, it is that Oregon has a relatively healthy individual market, and the premiums for young adults are comparatively low. And so healthy young adults who want to search out individual premiums may do okay. And so the concern would be that if we implemented a mandatory or at least an optional program for young adults to stay on as dependents, that the healthier young adults would go into the individual pool. The less healthy young adults would go into the small group pool. Raising rates ever so slightly for that pool. And I think that is part of the question that we're trying to figure out, is exactly what would that do to that small group pool. And at Representative Cannon's request, we are getting one of the actuaries from insurance company to sit down with him and try to walk through some of those details, see what we can figure out, because we don't really know. There is another question about how will employers respond. At least according to the agents that I work with, most employers do not cover dependents. They tend to cover the employee and then make it an option, in some cases, for the employee to buy dependent coverage. So under that model, there certainly are ways to make it work for more dependents to be part of that, as long as the employee is making the payment. Some of the states, and I think New Jersey's does this, is that they allow a premium bump over a certain age, because from the actuaries, the underwriters perspective, 20-somethings, the biggest additional expense there tends to be pregnant women, and that's the cost. And so they allow a 5% bump in premium or something to help cover that additional cost. So I think those are the primary concerns that have been raised. Oh, the one other interesting question, I guess, there are some employers that do cover dependents. You help control some of that. PEB and the new teachers, OWEB education pool, are probably two of the biggest ones that cover dependents. It'll be very interesting to see how they respond to this request and how they would handle dependent coverage up to a higher age. My wife's a teacher. Our insurance is through school districts, and I don't know how OWEB's going to do it, but under the current plan, it's up to age 26. And there's not a full-time student requirement.
Yeah,
if they're a dependent.
Data on that.
They have to be a dependent.
Which means not emancipated?
You know, it's very interesting trying to figure out what it means, frankly, because my daughter's right at that. It's bumping up against that. And the information that we get is not clear about exactly what that means.
Maybe we could hear
from I'm always my operating assumption has always been, if I can claim her dependent on my taxes, mm-hmm. she's a dependent. Mm-hmm. If I can't, then she's not. Mm-hmm. But I may be wrong in terms of what the insurance company thinks.
Question. Mr. Powell's remark about the building reminded me of a famous radio skit. Some people are old enough to remember radio, and it was it was about what could be done on radio that could not be done on television. And there was a comedy program with Red Skelton and Jerry Colonna. I don't think there's anybody old enough to remember those names. Me and
Red Skelton.
There you go. And the skit is Colonna's out on a job, and he calls Red Skelton, who's the boss, and says, "Red, I got a question about building a house." He says, "Yeah, Colonna, what's the question?" He says, "When you build a house, you build it from the bottom up or the top down?" Skelton says, "You dummy, you build it from the bottom up." There's a pause, and Colonna says, "All right, guys, come on down." In this case, I think we are talking about the question of whether you build a house from the bottom up or the top down. And the question is, do we have a base for adding something that might improve the situation? I mean, we don't know what's going to come out of 329 and how that's going to work. One would hope if an omnibus proposal comes out of it, it'll cover this issue. But it is, I think, a lot easier to take the next incremental step when you're building it on an existing base. Now, that's a hypothesis, and it may not be the correct hypothesis, and I think that's the thing you all are talking about. Is it just far more difficult to try and do this marginal additional step inside an existing marketplace, or is it going to be easier to do it some other way?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the question is valid, and the response also requires, how do you do it? For instance, The government's normal response is, let's just make a mandate. By golly, it's going to be required, which we have the power to do, but the consequences on the citizens and on the taxpayers and the policypayers, they're the ones that have to bear it. Another way to do it is through incentives that don't really cost necessarily. For instance, supposing that Oregon set up an exchange under 329, and we say we would like companies to cover dependents to an older age. And so those companies that do that will be premier country companies as far as where would they get listed on the exchange or something like that. And so, and through transparency, companies, we'd like you to be able to show what you provide in these areas so that a educated buyer can compare and say, well, wow, I've got kids that are getting up in age, and this company charges about the same as this one, but it covers coverage up to age 30 or age 26, and this one cuts it off at age 23. Now you have an informed purchaser who has an opportunity to make an informed decision on buying, and it's not because of mandate, but it's about companies. Just a really quick aside, we require seatbelts to be covered. You know, kids have to wear seatbelts. Well, I grew up in a time, and my kids are growing up, when you didn't require that. But I started doing it when USAA said, we will double the cost, we will double your coverage of medical insurance if you are involved in an injury and you're seatbelted. And so I remembered, okay, kids, buckle up.
Gig's over.
Because it was free additional coverage. I didn't plan on getting a crash, but it was an incentive to me. It didn't cost anything. The company did it. And as a response, I wanted that company because it gave me more coverage for being safe, and it didn't cost me anymore. And so I'm just saying that we can do it through mandates, and we can also find ways to encourage greater competition and greater benefit.
Well, I am intrigued with what Representative Cannon was talking about before, and as long as I was involved in health insurance, I knew that was the case, that there was a one-person, two-person, and family. Well, I mean, that's a matter of social policy where we've decided small families are going to a certain extent, subsidize larger families as a matter of social policy. I don't know where that happened, but I know it happened before 1964 when I became involved in this field. And, I mean, that's a very interesting issue. Why?
It used to be two spouse and one child and then two or more.
Right.
I mean, and so they had that. And so we start off with twins, and so we automatically kind of in there.
But families with a couple of kids are subsidizing families with a lot, or somebody is subsidizing.
Right. And part of it, I think, comes down to there's not that many, and the additional administration costs, and so they kind of balance it out, and they say, you know, how many families are there with three or more kids in today's society? And it's not that many.
This Representative Gelser.
I think there's someone on the list first.
Oh, I wasn't looking at my list. Sorry. Representative Bonamici and then Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to go back to something that Mr. Barber said about the relatively healthy individual market in Oregon. And when I think about that, and then I look at the proposal that talks about how obviously there's parental involvement in this. An adult child isn't just going to say, I want to be added to my parents' policy without somehow or another involving the parents. And if we assume, which this says, that premiums can increase for the added cost of insuring the dependent, I wanted to get some kind of sense of what's the difference that we're talking about here. Say, for example, an adult child said, Mom and Dad, I want you to pay for my policy that I'm finding out here in the relatively healthy individual market in Oregon.
Cell phone bill.
I just want to get a sense of what we're talking about in terms of what would the difference in cost be between that individual market policy versus the adding the adult child to the parent's policy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, if you don't mind, I'll take that because I do have some data that maybe at least give you an idea. And that is the cost of individual coverage for young adults right now at Regents under a $500 deductible policy, which has co-pays for pharmacy and office visits that you don't have to meet that deductible. So it's actually a richer benefit than a normal $500 deductible where you have to have $500 out of pocket before it pays maybe 80%. So this has some first dollar coverages in it. But for somebody between 25 and 29 years of age, it's $164 a month. And 30 to 34 years of age, it's $187 a month. So that would give you a range or an idea of what it would cost. Individual coverages many times are less expensive than group coverages because they do not have all the mandated benefits and that sort of thing. So if this was extrapolated from a very rich group policy, it would be more. A portability policy from that group policy would also be more because all the mandates have to be in the policy. But
it's also underwritten for health conditions, too.
Mr. Chairman, an individual policy would be, not a portability policy, arranged properly, but an individual policy would. And it's interesting in this later discussion, you know, the high-risk pool was created off from an incident that we're talking about today. An executive with Union Oil Company was ready to retire. His daughter was a senior at Oregon State University. He, in filling out his retirement papers, had a decision to make as to whether to cover on his retirement policy a husband and spouse, or a husband, spouse, and child. Well, she was 3 months from graduation, so he just took husband and spouse. Within that 3 months, she was diagnosed as being diabetic. And that then kept her from being accepted on an individual policy when this was determined. So this gentleman spent the next 4 years of his life in this building, running around grabbing people like me, and not just for his own case, because I think he had enough resources of his own, but he wanted to solve this problem for people in the future. And it was really his perseverance that led to the creation of the high-risk pool when it was actually created. And he may still be on the board of that, of OMIP, I'm not sure. But it came from a situation just like some of those that were described today.
It's a nice legend.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's my recollection. that's not.
I thought it came out of the health, out of the Oregon Health Plan Commission deliberations.
No, Mr. Chairman, it was a totally separate one. Governor Kulongoski was insurance commissioner at the time. I remember the day we met and the rules. He signed the rules for the plan. And the rules took a long time to develop as well.
Okay. Are there other Representative Gelser and then Representative Kotek?
Thank you. That was actually a great lead-in to my question, which was how stable in the long run is that high-risk pool? Because when you talk about ensuring dependents, those that are raising children that will always be dependent, that will never be on their own, that won't be able to qualify for individual coverage policies, have to make very difficult decisions about their futures. I know our family was counseled when our son was born to not save any money for him, to plan for him to grow up and be Medicaid eligible and eligible for government services. And to me, that's always seemed like an untenable and almost unethical position for a family with resources just for the purpose of accessing medical care to completely abdicate care of that child to the state for eligibility. And I'm wondering how we might help more people know about that high-risk pool and what that stability is far into the future so that people aren't making decisions planning to buy into that and then all of a sudden finding that that they were counting on that and suddenly they're without ability to cover that individual.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Gelser, there's two points there. One is if a person is, or a young person is considered totally disabled, they are able to stay on the parents' policy, one. And two, there would also be, at the given age, the portability policy model as well. But to your question directly, the high-risk pool is highly subsidized by a couple dollars per member per month from all insurers. And it is stable in that sense, in that the subsidy, these people are paying, I believe it's about 106% of the average individual premium Some states have a much higher amount that they pay. So that leads to a very heavy subsidy because their premiums fall far short of covering their claims. And so I think it's twice a year the insurers are assessed, or maybe it's quarterly, they're assessed for what OMIP's going to need in order to balance their books. So it's stable in that sense. It's an expensive pool, there's no doubt. And the issue of how much the people participating in that pay is always a question as well.
Subsidies, how much now, John? Do you remember?
Mr. Chairman?
40%.
Mike, how much is it?
Big amount of money.
I think it's 40%.
I was wondering how much money.
The subsidy in OMIP per member per month. Is it like $2.50 or something?
Well, it's more than that.
Is it?
PMPM, that sounds.
You were trying to hide from me. Mr. Becker here. We had no intention of letting you.
Mr. Chair, as we're coming up there, if I can also ask a question. And I don't want to hijack this conversation about OMIP, but or about, you know, dependency coverage, but this OMIP, I think, does play into the conversation. Is Oregon's high-risk pool a success story? And because there's a lot of conversation in a lot of states about establishing risk pools, and if my recollection is correct, we had conversations because there was something about, I can't remember the bill we were talking about, but it seemed to me that the consensus was Oregon's high-risk pool is a success story in terms of high-risk pools. And is that, am I incorrect in that? Or, you know, it's a value judgment, but what is your thought?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Maurer, I believe the stability of the high-risk pool would be considered a success story. The definition of success is probably most defined by who pays. And, again, in Oregon, the decision has been made to heavily subsidize this pool and do it by spreading it out through those who are insured. There are some issues now within how that's broken down, and there's a board to deal with all of those issues. So I think overall you could say it's a success.
About 50,000 people, is that right?
Probably about 50.
Representative or Chairman Greenlake, Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. The number of enrollees in OMIP, my recollection is it's about 18,000 currently.
It's relatively small.
Chair Greenlake, my understanding is that as high-risk pools go, Oregon is one of the larger risk pools in the country. I believe only the state of Minnesota currently rivals it for the number of individuals enrolled in the program.
I think there's some fragility in it, though, because this whole question of the subsidy has increased quite a bit in the last couple of years, and the question is who's covered and how that subsidy is distributed became a major issue that we heard testimony on in the last session, and really in the question of is it a percent of the total premium for third-party insurers or whatever that is. I don't know, but it is. I think there are some issues. Did you get your question answered, do you think?
I think so, but I wanted to follow up. You said that completely dependent individuals can permanently stay on their parents' insurance?
According to the RIA.
Yeah. Chair Greenlake and Representative Gelser, that is my understanding, that if you meet the age requirement up to age 19, you stay on your parents' policy. If you continue on as a full-time student and are a dependent, you likewise can stay on your parents' policy with most insurers. And similarly, my understanding is that if you are an adult of any age but a dependent, a disabled dependent on your parents, you can continue to stay on your parents' policy. That is my understanding.
That is, I think that that is a piece of knowledge that's not very well known by the people that need to know that. So thank you for that.
It's right there. Representative Kojak?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would be helpful to have scheduled in the interim maybe a presentation on OMIP and where we are. But to bring it back to the dependent coverage, and I should know this, but that's why a presentation would be helpful. Who qualifies for the high-risk pool? Because I want to go back to the comment about we have individual plans that are affordable. Well, we heard testimony that you put migraines on your application, you're held up as possibly having a pre-existing condition. So do we need to develop a mid-range pool here for folks who are in a relatively healthy age range who might have some mild, you know, thing that keeps them from getting covered? I don't know how we deal with that. We're trying to come around with ways to, you know, keep people covered with their families, but really they want to go out and buy an individual plan, but, you know, a small pre-existing condition makes them ineligible. But I would guess they're not eligible for the high-risk pool unless they have something seriously wrong. So I don't know the answer to that, but to me it comes back to how do we deal with some of the pre-existing, because that's how we keep it cheap, because you're selecting out the healthiest young folks who don't have any problems. So, oh, golly, it is inexpensive. But then you can't get on if you have any slight problem.
Then you go to the high-risk pool.
Well, that's the question. Can you get in?
My understanding is anybody who's been declined for health reasons.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kotek, that is correct. And it would be good, as was mentioned earlier, to have an interim presentation just to bring everybody up to date on the OMIP pool, and I'm sure Rocky and his staff would be very pleased to do that.
But get one next week. The
point in regard to relatively healthy individuals going on the high-risk pool, would that be something that would want to carve out in some sort of intermediate risk pool? I think what you might hear from Rocky is that that would probably not be advisable, because to the extent that we can get relatively healthy individuals who have potential risk problems, health problems, in that pool who are not using the coverage, it does help the overall stability of the high-risk pool.
And Mr. Follow-up?
Please.
And that would be my assumption, so I'm glad you brought that up. So my question, which I will pose to Rocky, is why aren't we telling every student who's moving off who might have something going on that you would be eligible for the high... I don't know if anyone back who testified knew anything about the high-risk pool.
That boyfriend would have been...
Well, I'm just saying, I mean, going back to your comment about we have this gap, people are falling off, we're not doing the best we can to make sure if you can't purchase an individual plan when you get out of school, for example, that you know about the high-risk pool, so there is no gap in coverage until you have group coverage or whatever else.
And Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, for the insurance agents, you know, if I hear a complaint about the individual market, it is that relatively healthy people are not being accepted into it. And we've worked with the carriers over the years, tried to develop both on the policy side and occasionally tweaking state law to try to help that, because they're the ones who see it. They see the people who are not being accepted into the individual plans. And I think that there may be a psychological resistance by people to say, yes, you know, I have migraines, therefore I'm high risk, or I have
overweight.
Whatever.
Modestly overweight.
Whatever it is. I mean, some will say it doesn't take much.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the cost factor, if you can continue coverage, group coverage through COBRA, through your family plan, which I'm hearing is a possibility, is for continuity?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kotek, you could, a family that is kicked off could use the COBRA plan. Correct. An individual that leaves would come under the Oregon portability statute, which requires the insurer of the group to provide them with a portability policy, which includes the mandates. So there's two things there. One is if the whole family, say the employer goes out of business, that family is eligible for COBRA coverage. In this case, the family staying with the employer, if this individual is leaving, and they can pick up a portability policy.
And follow up? The cost to, if you were comparing, again, this is my lack of knowledge on the OMIP, if you were paying for that portable coverage versus paying for coverage under OMIP, comparable cost to the individual purchasing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cote, it probably would be comparable because the portability cost is more than an individual policy by quite a little bit. An age 25-year-old would pay $164 for an individual policy and a $208 a month for a portability policy. So I think the surcharge is about, isn't it 106%? It was at one time 106% of premium. It might be a little higher than that.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kotek, I believe the OMIP charge is 125% of the commercial market. The statute limits it up to 125%, and I believe most recently it was moved to that amount.
Thank you.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I think that this discussion illustrates part of what motivates me to bring forward this bill, the complexity of options. And there are options out there, even options for young people with pre-existing conditions under the right set of circumstances and assuming a certain amount of means. But we have the complexity is hard. It's especially hard for a 22, 23, 24-year-old who's dealing with other kinds of life changes and going in and out of work, going in and out of school, traveling, taking time off. And, we could talk about the role that personal responsibility has in all of this, and certainly we shouldn't put that to the side. Nevertheless, I think that just the complexity here suggests that if it is possible to provide an additional option, and really the inertia option, the option of just sticking with what we've had, because that's what we know, it may not be even the most affordable or the best plan for the 24-year-old, the hypothetical 24-year-old, but it's what they know, what they've had. It seems reasonable to try to provide that option for them, and I think we'd see that to do so would have a significant effect on lowering the number of uninsured 20-somethings. So I really do appreciate the discussion and the input that we've gotten from all of you.
Just because we're speaking on this, I'd like to go ahead and comment on that. Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, an additional option that is free for the insured is very attractive. So this option essentially is the person who is 24 can just continue to have coverage for free.
I don't think I heard that.
But that's what happens with group insurance, because if you say in the policy that you're covered until 30 instead of 23, then that means the policy keeps going. Parents keep paying whatever they're paying. The employer keeps paying whatever he's paying based on this coverage. And the person who's insured just stays insured. I mean, it's not like they have to come in and pay any part of that. So that's a pretty, I think it's a beneficial thing for the person who turns 24 or 25 and still has coverage under their parents' policy. But it isn't free insurance. Somebody's paying for it. And so it just gets spread out over the group. And if you keep the same bands, so now it's parents with children, but the definition is older, then the underwriting just means that you have to build in the additional costs, and the price for everybody in that category goes up, unless you have a new band that says, they also parents with children and children that are over age 24, but that's a different...
Mr. Chair, let me just point out, I think the assumption that you're making is that the parent doesn't qualify with the child leaving at 23, doesn't qualify for a different band, and therefore reduce their cost, right? You're assuming that the child who stays on is in the same rate band as the family remains in the same rate band as they would otherwise be. If it's a family with only one child who's going to go from employee, spouse, and child to employee and spouse at age 23 when the child drops off, they're going to see a drop in their premiums. So,
but I don't see why we have to make that assumption at all.
I agree.
This sort of mountain goat leap in logic from one place to the rest. I mean, it would seem to me we ought to be able to look for a solution that would allow
additional coverage.
That would allow the family to pay for that additional coverage. It seems to me this can be a market solution just as well, but simply adds another way, and that's why I was probing the Blue Cross region as to whether it's feasible. It seems to me it's perfectly feasible to now say your child has reached 24 or 19, depending on whether they're in college or not, to keep them on your family coverage, we're going to send you a quarterly bill for this amount of money. And I think most families would lap it up to be able to pay for that if that bill could cover. And as John said, anything's possible, but it might be expensive to do. But it seems to me that is the kind of model.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, again, John Powell, representing Regents. Again, unless you're going to allow these individuals age 24 to 30 to go on and off at will,
I wouldn't necessarily.
Then there are those options currently. One is the portability provision, where a person can get it if they achieve that coverage within 63 days.
Well, benefits change with that, though, right?
Pardon?
Benefits are likely to change.
Mr. Chairman, the portability policy must, there may be some change in the policy, but the portability policies must cover the mandates. So it's a pretty rich benefit. That's why the cost is higher. And that's why we urge when the mandates are being applied, at least leave them off the individual policy. It gives an option for people to get coverage at a lesser rate. And those individual policies usually cost less than a group policy. But, you know, I, again, in summary, with over the last 20 years, as Oregon has reformed the market here, again, it's important. Many of these issues have come up over time and been answered, as I pointed out, with the high-risk pool. But before that, the guaranteed issue for small groups, 2 to 25, the other group, larger groups, didn't have trouble getting people to bid on their coverage and bargain for it. We've created the high-risk pool, so anybody, regardless of what their illness is or how sick they are, with, I believe, a six-month waiting period, can buy into coverage. And so over the years, we've pretty much tackled a lot of the access issues, the affordability issues, in part because we've tackled these. It makes it more expensive because guaranteed issue, for example, a group of two or three, and somebody in the family's ill can become an employee of that group and immediately get coverage under that group. So it is more expensive, but as a group in Oregon, we've determined that's good social policy to try to have basically an array of products and opportunities to access health insurance. Anyone living in Oregon can get health insurance. The issue comes back to cost. When you add a benefit or a requirement somewhere, there are consequences to that. Somebody's going to pay more somewhere in that system. You're going to squeeze it. It's going to pop up here or there. But we're happy to continue to participate in this and refine all of these issues as closely as we can for you.
Representative Cote?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just wanted to thank everyone for coming. I think I'm looking forward to the continuing conversation. I just wanted to say to Representative Richardson, I know some parents would probably make their kids pay for the dependent coverage, so I don't know if it would be totally free. they'd say, I'm getting charged more. Here's your part, Auntie Up.
Yeah, but sure. Sharing is the nicest part of having, even in terms of sharing a bill.
Yeah, there you go. I have a comment that's not related to this that I wanted to make around this age range. Is this an appropriate time?
Yes, please.
You know, one of the groups of young adults we don't cover well in the state is children aging out of foster care. And we have options that we have not taken advantage of here in the state to expand our Oregon health plan coverage to that category of folks, even if they're in college. You know, they don't have that family network to depend on, and so often they are on their own. And so I hope that's something we can tie into this conversation, looking at what we can do in terms of the subsidized coverage for the kids that basically were the responsibility of the state and now are moving on but don't have those supports and really should be covered until they're 24, 25, 26.
Yes, Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a quick question going back to something that I believe it was Representative Gelser mentioned about the letting people know if they're eligible for OMIP. And there is a notice requirement that insurers need to include a notice of the existence of OMIP in any adverse underwriting decision. And so I wonder if people in the industry could talk about, is that working well? Does it need to be a better notice? Is it buried in fine print? Or what seems to be the... there seems to be an issue with that because people don't know about it when they may be eligible.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, in most instances there's an agent involved, and if they're marketing and to the individual market in particular, that they're very familiar with that program and work with Rocky and his staff closely. So I think there is, for the most part, someone there to deliver that message, and the insurer is required to send a notice with any declination.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I worked with a constituent that had that issue, and Blue Cross in particular was very helpful in trying to help that individual. They had the impression that they would never be eligible for insurance, so they weren't planning to apply in the first place, and so they would not have gotten the notification. But Blue Cross and their customer service representatives were very helpful in explaining to this individual that it was well worth it to go through the process of making the application and applying, and then they would get the notice, and then they would be eligible. So I think that that's that's the trigger to help people who know that they're going to be declined, said, yes, you need to go ahead and apply. You need to have that rejection in order to be eligible for this other thing that you don't necessarily know you're eligible for until you've applied and been declined.
Well, I'd like to thank you all. Particularly, I'd like to thank you, Representative Kent.
I thought Representative Boone had a comment.
Please, so Gelser answered it.
You've been so nice and quiet.
Well, my question was, do you need to be turned down by a private insurer to qualify? And you mentioned that, so that was my question.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you all very much. We'll be hearing more about this. Representative Campbell, thank you for bringing it, and to Ms. Cassidy and Ms. Cecil Levine, thank you very much for bringing this, for your testimony. It's always fun to have our citizens here in the People's Building. Committee will be meeting tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to talk about the governor's role in looking at oversight of health licensing boards, how they think that's happening. Wednesday we'll be dealing with the question of public membership on boards. Thursday, what do we got for Thursday? There are two things on Thursday, I think, right? One of the clinical trials.
Correct, and then our second question, the administrative arm for oversight over regulatory boards, and we'll look at the premise of that.
Okay, and
you just said you might need them Friday.
If it looks like we're really going to be done over the weekend or on Monday, and there is that possibility, then I really would like to have a meeting on Friday if there is unfinished business we have. If not, we will not meet on Friday, so... it'll be good news and bad news.
Is that a definite maybe?
It's a definite maybe. The House Committee on Healthcare is adjourned.